good friend of mine, this great big guy that's been in security his whole life, was at the Las Vegas Mandalay Bay massacre. And his buddy was a combat Marine. And as soon as the shooting started, he told my friend Matt, hey, watch the girls. And he started running towards the sound of the gunfire.
Welcome to the Circuit Magazine, the number one source of information on protection matters, the industry-leading magazine for all security professionals who want to stay ahead of the game.
Active shooter training and the protector. Today, John Moss and myself are delighted to be welcoming Michael Julian, founder of Alive, the active shooter training program. John, why is this an important topic? Obviously, we are very sensitive to current affairs, but for the protector, why is this an important area to look at?
Yeah, well, first of all, I mean, I guess it's kind of obvious as to why it's an important topic, especially with recent events. But, you know, specifically for the protector, look, the clue is in the name. If you're a protector, then you're interested in protecting. And the whole thing about an active shooter incident is that we hope for somebody to stand up, you know, and be the man, be the woman, be the child potentially, you know, that has that inherent protector character about them and will, you know, stand up. Because that's what it's going to take at some point, you know, whether that's the police coming in through the door or whether that's, you know, you inside the building taking that initiative. It is a protector mentality. So as protectors, it's something that should resonate with all of us, I believe.
Indeed. And I guess what are our frames of reference for today's discussion? You know, are we talking school locations, places of worship? Are we talking corporate locations? And similarly, what are some of the challenges you think that our community are going to need to solve?
You know, I don't think necessarily we need to define the location. Obviously, you know, there's some that are going to be more relevant for the protector in a commercial setting and so on. But, you know, even a school, you know, initially you don't make the connection perhaps, but then I would say, well, the protector who is looking after a high net worth family and they have children, you know, it's very possible they might find themselves sat outside in a schoolyard, parked up in an escalator or something, you know, waiting just to do that pickup after they've done the drop off. So, you know, again, it could be relevant, but going back to what I said originally about the protector mentality, it's something, you know, and it's intertwined with situational awareness. It's about being aware of your surroundings at all time and being ready to take action as soon as it's required.
Indeed. And of course, whether it's RST or whether it's corporate, there's going to be a range of locations. And I suppose, you know, we do have to be a little sensitive to the current affairs. But one of the other topics we could cover in this interview, you know, making yourself a less appealing target, hardening, building and so on. Where do you think that is going to come into this training piece? Because I know many people, you know, look to take this Alive training or other run, hide, fight, run, hide, tell type training. Where do you think building and the built environment will come into?
Well, I think it's got to be at the back of everybody's thinking. You know, the Alive training and Run, Hide, Fight, it's designed, and I'm not the expert, but as far as I can tell, and we'll learn more about this soon, it's designed as a simplistic way to remember what actions you can take, you know, in the event of being caught out and with nothing at your disposal. But as protectors, it's our job to be thinking ahead. It's our job to try to be prepared and equipped for all eventualities. And also, you know, these are, you know, physical security procedures this is part of our bread and butter. So it's something that, yeah, we should be thinking about. It's something that we can have an opinion on and a say in when it comes to advising buildings, building owners and corporations and so on.
Fantastic. Okay, well, let's get into it. A very, very serious topic in a serious time. Active shooter training for the protector with Michael Julian.
And now, let's meet one of the contributors to the Circuit magazine.
Active shooter training for executive protection professionals. Today, we're very, very pleased to be joined by Michael Julian, founder of the Alive program for training in this scenario. It's a great pleasure to have you on. How are you?
Doing great, Phelan. Thank you.
Well, John Moss and myself, we're very keen to get into this. Obviously, there are some current affairs that are noteworthy, but one of the key questions, especially that came up on the Bodyguards for Kids initiative that we all supported, was how does this affect protectors? So why don't we start our three quick fire questions? What is the problem that we're trying to solve with this training?
That's a big question. Well, there's a few problems we're trying to solve. First of all, what's very different about my program than so many others out there is everybody teaches run, hide, fight, which is great. I do something similar. However, that's all they teach. They teach the physical functionality of running, hiding, and fighting. The problem is that we've seen so many people in this kind of, in the center of this type of chaos and craziness and death and carnage and fear and terror, people's brains lock up and don't tell their hands and their feet to run, hide, fight. So the first problem we try and conquer with the Alive program is to empower people, to make them understand that they do have a say in the outcome of that situation. Just because somebody's got a gun, they've got a weapon and you don't, because they're killing people and because they want to kill you, does not mean you just have to stand there or lay down and die. You have the power to make a difference if you so choose to do that. So that's kind of a big one. Also, the program we talk about, you know, prevention. Obviously, what's the best way to survive an active killing event? Prevent it. So we talk about the security mindset and the survival mindset. Now, the security mindset is learning, training, drilling, avoiding dangerous situations. If we can do that effectively, we never have to worry about the actual physical methodology of surviving the active shooter. We teach the warning signs so you can see, you know, potential violent behavior. And then what to do when you see the warning signs. So there's a whole bunch of stuff we do to get people prepared for this type of situation. And we know it works. I've got a survivor of the Las Vegas massacre at Mandalay Bay, a woman named Liz Moreno, who took my class in 2014 and contacted me after that event and said, "Hey, your training saved my life, because when it happened, I knew what to do." So, you know, and I won't put my competition down. Because any training, almost any training, is better than no training. I don't like the guys that scare their audience by not letting them know their buddy's coming through the back door to act like an active shooter to scare the hell out of them. So that's irresponsible. But just about any training is better than not having any training at all.
No, perfect. And then I guess obviously we're very grateful to have you on. But what is your passion for this come from?
My passion. That's a great question. I will be very, I will put my ego aside and let you know that it comes from purely selfish reasons, because I had anger and anxiety and angst, and I was literally just pissed off because I was watching good people die at the hands of bad people, and I was watching their reactions, and it was like watching a horror movie. I'm like, "Don't open that door. What are you doing? Don't, the bad guy's behind that door." They were doing the wrong thing, or they were doing nothing at all. And I was thinking to myself, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? But they didn't have a father that was military and law enforcement that taught them about situational awareness and being prepared for situations and taking action. And I thought, well, I need to resolve this feeling I have, because I don't like being helpless. I'm a control freak, like any good sheepdog. I don't like being helpless, and I don't like seeing other people hopeless. And I decided I was going to do something about it. So I started looking at other programs, and I thought that all the other programs, there was something missing, or I disagreed with something. And then I just decided to create my own. And I created the ALIVE program. And ALIVE is an acronym that I took about 2 days to figure out, because I thought ALIVE was a really good acronym, but then I had to go with the words. And it stands for Assess, Leave, Impede, Violence, and Expose. And the Leave, Impede, and Violence are parallel to Run, Hide, Fight.
Okay. Well, that's paints a wonderful picture that I think a lot of people could relate to, hopefully. For the uninitiated protector, let me do a slight nuance on that. Of course, lots of protectors will, of course, have an idea about active shooter situations. What about the protector that doesn't quite understand how it affects them? Because it's not necessarily an executive protection environment. What should they better understand?
Well, you know, I've had so many executive protection, professional students, because part of what we teach is situational awareness, being proactively reactionary. You know, we talk about, the recognizing the warning signs of impending violence. So, and then one of the things I talk about is, you know, I make the parallel of when we were younger and we were learning how to drive, we were taught defensive driving, which is simply, you know, looking around to see what drivers may not be paying attention or might be doing something that can hurt us, so we can prepare for and avoid that situation. So I liken it to, I just literally say defensive living. And I hate that I even have to create that phrase, but defensive living is just like defensive living. It's driving. It's looking around and seeing what people may act in a way that is harmful for you, and be prepared to counter it, avoid it, defend against it. So those traits and those things actually go very, very well with the protector's mindset, because you're not just protecting yourself. You're now being paid to protect somebody else. So you've got to be situationally aware. You've got to be proactively reactionary. You've got to be able to spot warning signs that could be dangerous to your principal, and then counter or defend against them.
I agree, Michael, 100%. In my opinion, if you're a protector, then this is important to you, regardless of whether or not this is something that you face every day, whether you assess that your client, you know, is vulnerable. It doesn't really matter. As protectors, you know, we care, as you just said, about keeping people safe. And so this has got to be on our radar. But, you know, beyond that, I see how the elements of the training, of the mindset, and of the planning and the procedures that you would put into place to combat this, it's totally transferable to what we do. And I just kind of wanted to delve into that a little bit more deeply. You've mentioned your ALIVE program and briefly, ran through the acronym and what that stands for. But, you know, I think it'll just like to pause here and delve into that a little bit more to give the listeners an idea of what it is that you've created. And also, you know, you referenced the run, hide, fight model, and, you know, how that differs, why you created ALIVE on the back of that, what wasn't working with run, hide, fight, if that's not too many questions to throw at you all at once.
Let me start with the last one first, because I have a short memory, so you'll probably have to refresh my memory on the first part. The last one, very, very good question, and very simply put, look, Run, Hide, Fight was made 25 years ago after Columbine. The government created it. They made a video. They've since, thank God, updated that video, because there was all kinds of problems wrong with it. But they nailed it. Look, it's like stop, drop, and roll. Okay, you're going to remember it, and it's the three basic things you need to do. So Run, Hide, Fight, it was the first version of active shooter survival. And we know the first version of anything is never perfect. Nobody gets it right the very first time. So you create something, you test it, You figure out what was wrong with it, you recreate it better, and then you test it again. It's the OODA loop. You keep going in circles until it's perfect. We call a live Run, Hide, Fight 2.0, or the new and improved version of Run, Hide, Fight. What we did is we took the first version of something and we made it better. And that was necessary because, you know, Run, Hide, Fight, especially the way they portrayed it in the video they created, was a little rough around the edges. And frankly, I used some of the Run, Hide, Fight video in my presentation to show people what not to do, even though they said to do this. So it actually worked out great for me. Luckily, the new Run, Hide, Fight video that I think the FBI or Homeland Security created is just absolutely 1,000% better than the old one. So I tell people, listen, if you can't afford it or you don't want to pay me or one of my instructors to teach the Alive program to your employees or your churchgoers or your family, please just show them that 10-minute video or whatever, because they finally did it right. So there's the answer to your last question. Let's back up to your first question and reiterate that for me.
Yeah. So if you just want to jump into the ALIVE acronym, you know, run through it again and perhaps just, you know, pause a little bit on each one of those steps and let's just talk us through it so we all have a clear picture of what it is.
Happy to do that. So the A in ALIVE is for assess. And this step is the most important step because everything you do moving forward after this step depends on how you carry out the first step of assess. The assess process is also the only non-physical step. It's psychological, mental. This is where you stop, take a deep breath, calm yourself so you don't react emotionally. You've got to force yourself to react rationally. We all know that if we react emotionally, it's very easy to make a mistake when you're thinking with your emotions, your ego, your heart, rather than your brain, right? Take a deep breath to get a burst of oxygen to those organs because the adrenaline's pumping and your heart's going 1,000 miles an hour and your body's starving for oxygen. And you assess what is happening. You heard shots. You can see people running, so you don't figure it's the backfire of a car. You know, you think, or maybe somebody's got a knife, or maybe there's fire or an explosion. Either way, it's a danger to you. You assess what is happening, and then based on your circumstances, what of the next steps in the ALIVE process are doable? Or what can you do using those steps to survive this situation? And of course, absolutely 100% between step one and step two, between assess and leave, you've got to call 911. We know that, and we just saw it in Nashville, that the sooner law enforcement gets there, the sooner the threat will either be eliminated, they will try and leave, or they will eliminate themselves. Okay. Now, whichever of those threes happens, what they're not doing is trying to kill us. Okay. So we've got to get the clock ticking. As soon as you call 911, we get the clock ticking and law enforcement. Some of these killers will kill themselves just hearing the sirens of approaching law enforcement, right? Let's get them there as quickly as possible. So assess, focus, rational response, you know, good breathing, and then you consider the next steps. Okay. You don't actually do them yet. You consider them. The next step, considering the next step, that's leave. Leave is like run. Can I leave? Can I extract myself from this danger? If you can do that, that's what you do, and you take as many people as you can, and you get the hell out of there, and you keep running until the guy or gal couldn't hit you with a gun if they wanted to. Okay, you don't stop like the first Run, Hide, Fight video says in a group of people next to a wall downstairs when there's a window up on the second floor where the guy could see you and start shooting at you like fish in a barrel. So first consideration, get the hell out of there if you can. If you cannot, you move on to the second consideration, which is impede. Impede is like hide, but hiding is like a victim mentality. It's defensive and it's weak. I want people to be empowered. And if you are leaving, or you are impeding, you are actually taking action rather than being nothing but a potential victim. And when you impede, you're going to create time and space. Time and space, whether it's going to create time so it takes them longer to get to you, it's going to create space. You're going to put a blockade or a barricade between you and them, because we know that The goal of it of an active killer is to kill as many people possible in a short amount of time as possible. That is my definition. That is the official alive definition of an active killer. It's a little different than the government's, but I believe it's time to reword that. That means they know the cops are on the way. And as soon as the cops get there, they can't kill anymore. And their whole objective is to kill as many people possible in a short amount of time as possible. So if you built a little barricade and they can get through that barricade, but it's going to take them 5 minutes, they're not going to spend that time, that precious time that they could be taking lives. They're not going to spend the time to get through that barricade. They're going to move on to I hate to say it, but lower hanging fruit, easier targets, you know, people they can kill. And if you can't do that by locking yourself in a broom closet or a copy room or somewhere where they can't get to you because they're right there or there's nowhere else you can go, then you're going to resort to violence. And there are people in this world that really don't like violence. They don't like the word. They don't like the thought. They don't like the action. And that's great. We need people like that. That's how we're born. They didn't become jaded and trained and ready to commit violence like we did. But now they're going to have to, because if it's between you going home to the people you love or you dying right where you are, and the thing that's going to differentiate those is committing violence, then you have to commit violence. And when I say commit violence, I mean with extreme prejudice. You don't just try and, you know, I had a person say, well, can you just hit them in the arm with the fire extinguisher so they can't hold the gun anymore? And I said, well, they got two hands. So how about if we just hit them over the head so hard that they don't wake up for a day? You've got to do this with every ounce of your being, because if you don't, you could die that day. And another part of the problem, the reason people become paralyzed is because they're thinking of their loved ones and seeing their faces and thinking, I'm never going to see them again. And it's debilitating. It will paralyze them. So you can't do that. And then the last consideration is to expose your position carefully for two reasons. One, just because you haven't heard shots in a while doesn't mean the shooter's not still there. There may be a second shooter. They may have been reloading. Maybe they walked somewhere to find people and came back. Or you may take off running and run around the corner and startle law enforcement. Maybe the SWAT team's coming in and they don't know you're the good guy, and they shoot you, which has happened. So the assess process kind of spells out the rest. You're going to consider those, and then you're going to choose which one you can do. And you go with leave first, impede second, and violence is a last resort.
Yeah. So as soon as you started talking about assess there, I immediately made a similarity to medical training. And, you know, the first thing that you do when it...
Triage.
Yeah. And as soon as you come across any casualty... Is there any further danger to myself or the casualty before you step in, before you get involved? And we like to say in the UK, we take a condor moment and stop and assess. Now, what I always, not always, but, you know, more often than not, observe in a training situation, which will then obviously carry through into real time, is that assess moment, which, as you've just outlined, is absolutely crucial. But in training, it literally becomes a sentence that we say, is there any further danger to me or the casualty? You're asking, you know, the trainer, they'll tell you yes or no. You then proceed. And you're not actually, you know, training, you know, those neural pathways and, you know, firing. What can you do in the assess period of the training? And I'm asking you about that one particularly because I realize how important it is, you know, to get that real-time training so that when you are in that situation, it will kick in.
Let me see if I understand the question. What can we do in that real... Say that again, please. Simplify the question for me.
Okay, so beyond, like I said with the medical example, beyond just saying, you know, okay, I'm assessing the situation. I'm telling the trainer what I'm doing. You know, what are the mechanics of actually learning, you know, to get yourself calm? Like you mentioned breathing, you know, and I totally see the point of that. I think a lot of us are much more aware of breathing as a concept now rather than just an automated function. But I'm not so sure that there's still many of us practicing it, you know. So if there's any techniques or, you know, just the process itself, if there's anything you can speak to that in that assessment sure. period for getting a calm sure. head.
Yeah, and if you've ever heard Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman speak, then you know how important breathing is to your survival and being effective to defend yourself or whatever. So I talk about, there's a reason why I tell people, and I say, I want you to pay attention to my hands. And I say, I want you to think, when you start to assess, you realize what's happening, take a deep breath, and you exhale as you bring your hands down. And I want this visual to be a funnel of all of the crazy thoughts and craziness and chaos and fear funneling down and coming out as stone cold, rational, concentrated, focused thinking. You take a deep breath to get that. Well, it's kind of a trick. If I tell people you've got to take a deep breath, it's going to center them. And this is kind of centering as well. If they're centered, they're not distracted by the pictures of their loved ones, their children, not walking their daughter down the aisle, not seeing their son graduate from college, all of the things that will literally send you into a tailspin psychologically and take your concentration away from survival. So I talk about taking a deep breath and basically focusing. Now, one of the exercises that I do for everybody in our program is I call it the visualization exercise, and I will literally walk them through a scenario familiar to them, and I call that being proactively reactionary, which is it's like jumbo shrimp. They don't make the two different words that mean the opposite thing. Being proactively reactionary is proactively before creating your reaction, which will come after. So you're literally in your mind. I tell everybody, okay, close your eyes. And I walk them through this journey of picture yourself where you work 8 hours a day, sitting at your desk or standing wherever you are. You spend a lot of time. Now, all of a sudden you hear pop, 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 and you visualize that coming from where it would likely come from if somebody had a gun and they were coming into the building. Now we're going to go through the assess process and we go through all five steps. And then I walk them down that journey with their eyes closed, imagining, visualizing that scenario in their mind based on where they spend time, because I don't know where they spend their day. They do. So I literally train them how to react based on a scenario. Then I back up and I say, now let's do the same scenario, but instead of the shots coming from there, which means you had a path to leave there. Now it's coming there and they're blocking the exit. What are you going to do? Now you have to impede or commit violence. If people are and by the way, I talk about, and my book is called 10 Minutes to Live, Surviving an Active Shooter Using Alive, because based on my research, before it was 99%, but now after Nashville, it's 98%, because that one took 14 minutes. But all of the most serious active killing events in history were over in 10 minutes or less. Virginia Tech, Las Vegas, 10 minutes exactly. 69% of them are over in 5 minutes or less. What does that mean to us? That gives the intended victim hope, knowing, hey, it's going to be over soon. So you focus on the finish line. You focus on the prize, and that is survival. So I'm literally telling people what to focus on, that don't worry, just last a couple more minutes, because statistically speaking, that means they're going to survive. I'm telling them to focus on things that will keep them alive, not focus on things that will get them killed by paralyzing them because they think, well, he's got a gun. I'm never going to see people again. I just saw someone else get killed. I'm going to die today. And there are multiple examples where people have just resigned themselves to perishing that day because of fear and paralysis. Because of the intensity of the emotions and the stimulus coming in, the mosque in New Zealand is the perfect example. I show that video in my program. Those people literally walked over to two separate corners, laid down face first, and waited to die. And you cannot do that. You must take action. I hope that answered your question.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And actually really well. I have to say, the image and the technique of the funnel, it's incredibly powerful. I actually went through that as you were talking it, and I could feel, you know, how you can compress and squeeze down and really get on top of, you know, all of this that's going on. And I haven't, in this moment, sat here, you know, with yourself on this podcast, I haven't got nearly as many things to be thinking about. But even in, you know, with that short example, I was able to feel that's good. Really great. Think there's a lot that people can take away from that. So okay, you know, you've did a great job there of, you know, encapsulating all the emotion, the whole drama of being in a situation like that. And your final point about the time, it's not really something I'd heard put across like that before. And I think that's a really interesting way to look at it. You know, to imagine and to know statistically, you know, that this could be over in as little as 10 minutes. And it's a case of, you know, staying sharp, staying switched on and maintaining the will to live. I mean, if you've never been in that situation, I don't suppose you can really relate. You need somebody like yourself to be able to spell that out. And I thought that was really powerful. And one of the things that immediately made me think of is, okay, so, you know, we're trying to survive this. We've survived it. You know, the active shooter is dead. But wow, there's still a hell of a lot going on post-incident now. I mean, how do you recover from this? How do you control the situation? How do you control yourself? How do you move on? I mean, is that something that you can speak to? I know you're Alive is very much focused around the active shooter incident, but is that something that you've considered, the aftermath, the post-incident trauma and recovering from that?
I have most definitely considered it, but would never consider myself an expert enough to try and teach other people in that regard. But I will give you my personal non-professional perspective on that. This type, and it goes back to a perfect example. A good friend of mine, this great big guy that's been in security his whole life, was at the Las Vegas Mandalay Bay massacre. He and his buddy were there with his buddy's wife and two other girls. And his buddy was a combat Marine. And as soon as the shooting started, he told my friend Matt, hey, watch the girls. And he started running towards the sound of the gunfire, which wouldn't have done him any good. He never would have gotten to Stephen Paddock. He couldn't have gone up 33 stories, you know, to get to him. But that was his instincts. And that's one, you know, sheepdog mentality that honestly I think is too much, because he might have gotten himself killed. He didn't have enough information to effectively carry out some kind of, you know, attack on this guy. But Matt saw carnage and killing and blood and death and maiming and all of these things because he was right there. And he was devastated. And this is not some weak-minded, weak-bodied guy. Both of those guys were affected for a long time after that. So it doesn't matter who you are, unless you just don't care about human beings. Anytime something like you're experiencing something like this, there is going to be some after effects that can be very damaging. PTSD, 100%. I mean, he still, when he hears, you know, several loud pops, gets a little bit, you know, anxious. So when it's over, I don't know if you're talking about immediately once the shooter's down, or you're talking about for months or years after that. It's going to be a journey to come back from that to normal, if there is such thing as normal after experiencing something like that. So I would implore anybody to get some kind of counseling, and just preferably a group counseling with other people that were there, to talk about what happened and get that energy out, because it's debilitating. It'll eat away at you. You know, I knew guys that were in combat that didn't necessarily kill somebody, but they were in combat and they're still affected by it. And that's what it is. Honestly, it's combat, except you really can't fight back. But it's a very similar situation. So as far as afterwards, being very careful and taking care of yourself, because it will screw up your mind, I think, if you don't take care of it.
Yeah, I think that really emphasizes the point about doing everything that you can when you have the opportunity as well in the moment, because this is the thing, especially if you consider yourself an able person, i.e. somebody, you know, with knowledge, experience in the situation, somebody who believes that, you know, that they could do something, that they could affect the outcome. You want to know that you did everything that you could do in that situation, and you're not left questioning yourself, because I know that, you know, just as you described there with that case study, you know, we are big guys, you know, we might have egos, but we're our own worst critics, and we will destroy ourselves if there's any questions left unanswered or that we felt where we felt we could have acted better.
Oh yeah, definitely. Oh, I'm sorry, Phil. I think especially people like us, I think a lot of people would have this, but especially sheepdog type mentality, survivor's guilt could be huge. If we survive and other people don't, or we run out instead of trying to go in and engage the shooter, that would be hard for some people, probably like you, definitely like myself, to deal with, because we know we can make a difference, but we may not have been able to make a difference with no gun and no idea where the person is. So
that is very poignant. And I think many people will relate to that. But I wonder, is there scope? Have you been working on it? Is it already in motion to apply the ALIVE methodology to someone with a principle? Because their task is to protect the principle, yet they may be in a neighboring incident. Do they leave the principle? Do you know what happens when the principle and the protector are inside an incident? I guess, how does that apply?
Yeah, great question. Get asked that a lot at executive protection conferences that I talk out and so forth. Sure. So, you know, one of the things that ALIVE teaches, especially in the assess process, is a certain amount of self-discipline. It's to block out the idea of dying and losing people and not seeing people again and focus on survival. That takes discipline to say, no, I'm not going to be emotional. I'm going to be rational. It takes the same discipline for somebody that might automatically, like a combat Marine, say, stay here and run towards a source of, you know, danger that you don't even know where it is or what it is, and go, okay, I've got to focus on the mission here. Now, the mission of a paid executive protection agent is to protect their principal and or the principal's family, whoever they're assigned and designated to protect. I use the scenario of, let's say, your RST or EP, and you take the kid, the principal's kid to school, and you wait outside till the kid's done. You're sitting there, you're reading a book, whatever. You still got 3 hours till the kid gets out of school, and you start hearing shots. You run into the building, and I'm not going to tell other professionals, you know, I'm not going to presume to be the one and only expert. I will just tell you what my opinion and my belief is as far as your duty. If you're paid to protect somebody, then you need to protect them first and foremost. And this may not be popular, especially with the parents of the other kids, but you go into that school, you find the kid you're paid to protect, and you get them the hell out of harm's way. Now, if you can do both, if you're running into the school to protect to get the kid out, and you run up against the shooter, then you take them out, obviously. But my opinion is your duty is to your principal, and that's what you take up for, deal with first. But some of the other stuff I teach, you know, like being proactively reactionary. What about if you're sitting there, you know, RST or EP, and you got time to kill, you start going through the scenario, the visualization exercise in your mind about what if my principal and I are where, or where he's the CEO and there's a shooting, what am I going to do? You know, and you start thinking about these scenarios, you walk through the problem and the solution in your mind, because let's face it, when's the worst time to create a plan? When you need the plan. The visualization exercise prepares you and gives you a plan so that it's not the subconscious you got to bring to here. It's right there and ready to go. So the protector, you know, obviously situational awareness. We have got to be situationally aware so we can, you know, the best way to protect your client or principal is to keep them out of harm's way rather than getting them out of harm's way. Okay. I don't want to be in a situation where I have to shoot my way out. I want to avoid that altercation altogether. Visualization, being proactively reactionary, creating your plan. But it always comes down to taking care of your principal first. And if you can do that and then be a hero, then great. But I would never tell somebody to go just be a hero and, you know, go find the shooter, because you've got somebody you're assigned to protect. You got to protect them first.
Yeah, it's a tough call, but I think many people will see that line of thinking. And then I guess because we have people listening from the US, but also the UK and other places, why, and maybe this is just me offering up a sacrificial question for you, why do you think that, let's say in the UK, they like to say run, hide, tell, instead of run, hide, fight? Why? I mean, I know you can't be inside their minds, but why do you think that exists as a concept?
I had a Silicon Valley, very progressive, new age, love the world, potential client contact me. They were a $1 billion company. They wanted my training, but they said, you know, we don't allow violence in our culture. We don't even like to say that word. So could you rearrange it and call it run, hide, tell, and not actually teach the violence part? And I said, well, no, I won't do that. And I said, and if you have somebody else do that, you're irresponsibly treating your employees and you're setting them up for failure. Now, I can talk about the fact that guns are not the big issue in the UK. It's more edged weapons, and there's more people killed, murdered with knives in London than there are people murdered with firearms in New York City. So, you know, edged weapons are a problem in the UK. But I've got instructors in Canada that don't deal with guns. I've got instructors in Australia that don't deal with guns. They teach active threat survival. And the methodology will work no matter what the threat is. It's countering violence. It's surviving violence. It doesn't have to be a gun. It just happens that that's what's happens in America because we have so many guns. And, you know, the guns are woven into our culture, our society, because we had to break away from the British so many years ago and said, we're never going to allow that to happen again. Run, hide, tell you're dealing with violence. You know, YouTube had that shooter, the female shooter 3 or 4 years ago, and they are very much a non-violence type of culture. Their people, thank God law enforcement was so good at what they did, because they really saved the day on that one. But their people were not prepared to commit violence against somebody else. And just because you don't want violence in your culture, that's fine. But what if somebody outside your culture brings it to your culture? Are you prepared to survive it, to counter it, to deal with it, to react to it? So I'm sorry, but I will not support taking. And in fact, since Uvalde, it has become kind of an industry understanding that it's time to rethink run, hide, fight, because run, hide, fight did not emphasize enough of the fight part of it. And they say do it as a last resort, which I agree with. But if you have to do it, you do it. And I'm saying with the intent to kill that person. Now, you don't have to kill them. If they're no longer a threat, you step back and that's fine. But, you know, my dad he taught me, if you ever need to punch somebody in the face to defend yourself, don't aim for their nose, aim for the back of their head. You're going to punch through their face so that you do so much damage that they are no longer a threat. If you are going to try and save yourself and others by committing violence against somebody, you just have the intention and the commitment to doing whatever is necessary, including taking their life if you have to. You don't have to. The commitment can stop when there's no longer a threat, but you've got to be able, willing and able, mentally and physically, to make that happen.
Yeah.
Did that answer your question?
And, you know, I've seen you, you know, put that argument across before. So that's why I sort of termed it a sacrificial question, because I think it's an important part of the debate. And one thing that just occurred to me as, let's say, a layperson, a lot of these attacks, at least in the popular press, seem to be with a long gun. Now, a long gun in an enclosed space. Maybe this is a question for some sort of martial arts, you know, podcast. I don't know. Do you think that there's something a little bit different about tackling someone with a long gun than another type of weapon? Is there something people could look into?
Well, one of the things we teach in the module B, which is the scenarios and simulations portion of my program, is how to basically disable a gun, whether it's a handgun or a long gun. And yes, long guns are used more often than not, but many times there's a long gun and a short gun as a backup. In fact, this person in Nashville had two AR styles and a handgun. When I talk about a shooter coming through a door, if they've got a long gun or a short gun and you're going to control that, especially if you're going to swarm as a group, you got two or three people lined up ready to go, you're going to control the trajectory of that round. And honestly, based on what I teach, I want to put that muzzle down and literally and grab the action of that weapon. And I hope they pull the trigger, because that round is going to hit the ground and ricochet and go somewhere else and not hurt somebody, because hopefully they shouldn't be in front of the person anyway. And I've now stopped the action of that weapon from putting a new round into the chamber. And it's a piece of metal. Unless they're able to clear that jam, which is not easy to do, you're just now fighting over a piece of metal that's not going to hurt you unless they can clear that jam. So I lost my train of thought. Tell me what was the question again?
Easier, difficult, different, tackling a long gun in close quarters.
I believe if it were me and I was going to go up against somebody, I would hope that they have a long gun, because that is going to be harder to maneuver in close quarters than a handgun. I can go like this and shoot you, but I literally have to go like this with the barrel of a long gun. And if there's a long gun, I can wrap that thing up and grab it and squeeze it, and they're not getting, believe me, I'm going to be kicking them in the shins and in the groin and in the knees and everything like that. So my personal preference would be, I hope they have a long gun, but either way, if you know how to do it, and we teach how to do it, you can disable that weapon, and then it's just you against them. They don't have superior firepower any longer.
Michael, I just want to briefly look at technology before we conclude this. Obviously, a lot of what we're talking about here, you know, is our own physical capabilities, what we can do. But I'm just interested to hear your thoughts on technology currently as it stands, where the gaps are. What is technology failing us? Are we not using the technology that's available? Is it simply that a lot of schools in places where we see active shooters opt not to implement the technology for various reasons?
Great question, John. Thank you. Okay. I tell people there's two things that have to happen to change this phenomenon, this situation we're dealing with. Training and physical security apparatus. Okay. Training clearly is what I do. That's what I want everyone to have. As far as the physical security apparatus, there's so many things we can do. The easiest thing that we can possibly do is just change the damn door handles on doors to have it so that you can lock it from the inside. We're talking about broom closets, storage closets, copy rooms, classrooms, offices. If you can lock it from the inside, they're not going to spend 2 or 3 minutes trying to get through that door. Also, there's shot detection. There's great shot detection systems out there, like Eagle Technologies has one. In fact, by the way, I don't know when this is going to air, but ICS West is this week, and I'm going to be in Vegas for that. They have all of the best technology for active shooter at ISC West. Shot detection, different kind of notification systems for campuses, ways that law enforcement can get alerted immediately and then have a schematic of the inside of that building that their guys can be walked through as they're going through that building. So there's really a lot of good technology that is not being used, that needs to be used. And look, in the 74 years or whatever it is since the federal government mandated fire drills in every school, public and private, throughout this country, there hasn't been a single kid killed in a school fire. And do you know that to build a new building, a third of the budget has to go for sprinklers and fire this and fire that? Simply start building and updating buildings with the kind of very simple and inexpensive security apparatus that we need to create time and space so that killer cannot get to you. So, yeah, there's a lot of things we can be doing that we're not doing, and we need to be doing it. Look, if budget is a problem, you can go on Amazon and get one of these things for about $9. Every single classroom in America can afford a $9 thing where you put in the door and this sucker will stop that door from opening. Okay. $9. I sell the Bolo stick, which is $70 and extremely effective. And $70 is way cheaper than $200 or $300 that some of these, but anti-intrusion, shot detection, early warning, notification systems. That's all technology that we can be using. And it's just a matter of time before it becomes mandatory, like all the fire systems and stuff that goes into every single building and retrofit that there is now.
Very passionate response. And it does, it makes you wonder why, you know, half of this technology isn't being implemented, especially at such low cost. And I think, Michael, you know, just to build on that and to finish out this, what's been a fantastic and enlightening episode, is just to get your take on what you think the evolution of these active shooter situations is going to be, you know, building on what you just said there.
Okay, so here's my theory. Based on my understanding of the psychological profile of the active killer, that they've got this hole in their soul, this lack of, you know, the lack of coping skills to deal with what's going on in their life, and they feel they have no power and control, whether it's anger and revenge because of something that they believe happened to them and somebody else is to blame, whether it's ideological, like somebody that, you know, they decide to be an extremist, and if you don't look and believe the way I do, then I'm going to kill you, or it's mental illness or personality disorder. It all comes down to the same thing, and that is a desire for power and control. Now, when they go and it could be self-loathing. It could be like the guy that killed Chris Kyle. He was so screwed up from PTSD and hated himself for what he'd done. He's like, well, I'm going to kill one of the most celebrated warriors in history, and now everybody will hate me as much as I do. If you are able to take what they believe they'll get out of an act like this away from them, they'll find some other way to express whatever pain or anger or whatever crap is going on inside their mind. So we have got to train everybody and stop these people from being successful. In 2019, in two different schools, one in North Carolina, one in Colorado, somebody burst through the door, the closest kid to them, they both had active shooter training, yelled gun, rushed them, grabbed them. They ended up going down and everybody else jumped on them. Now, here's the sad news. In both situations, both of those people that did that died. But the good news, everybody else around them survived. Now, they could have died standing there or running the other way because there was a classroom and they had nowhere else to go, or they could have fought to either save themselves and or everybody else. Those two killers were ineffective and unsuccessful. If we can get enough of those situations until the next potential active killer goes, wow, I saw them on the news, but all I saw was they were killed before they were able to hurt anybody. They didn't get the notoriety. They weren't successful. Look, there's two things about active killers everyone should know. The one thing they don't fear is death. And most times they have already fantasized about their own demise. And they want to have control over that. That's why they kill themselves. They don't want to be taken into custody. And if they're killed by somebody else, they still leave this mortal world on someone else's terms. If they kill themselves, they still go out with the power and control that they so desperately want. If they go and they try and do this and they won't succeed, the one thing they do fear is failure. If they don't think they're going to succeed, they're going to find some other way to do whatever it is they think they need to do to feel better about themselves. So that's what we need to do. We need to make it difficult or impossible for them to get into our schools, to our churches, to our malls. And then if they are able to, we need to be able to neutralize them before they're able to do what they're there to do. And if we do that enough times, people are going to go, well, that doesn't work anymore. I'm going to join a gym and start working out and get big muscles so I feel better about myself. Make sense?
That would be an amazing ideal. If we could get to that stage, and you mentioned, you know, harder target, softer target, and there's been speculation even this last week about that scenario. Obviously, we don't know enough about it, but it does paint a very valuable picture for our protector community. Wow, what a tour de force! I've really appreciated your time. John Moss and myself, we're very, very happy and honored to have you on. Michael, how can people get in touch with you?
So the website for live is activeshootersurvivaltraining.com. It's long, but very self-explanatory. If you ever want to find us, all you got to do is Google active shooter or a live active shooter. We're all over the internet. We're all over the world. My book called 10 Minutes to Live, Surviving an Active Shooter Using Alive. It's an Amazon bestseller in 6 categories. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it at the ASIS bookstore, the Sherm bookstore. You can get it on my website. The online program, there's online training, in-person virtual web training, webinar. And then if anyone's interested in becoming an instructor, it's a 2-day course. We've got one in-person and we've got one online every month. And if you want to learn how to, if you're a protector and you want to learn how to protect people more, this is a really good way to do it. And it's a great profit center because my program's probably one of the most popular out there right now. So it's very sought after and you know, it's valuable. So we charge money for it, obviously. So that's where you get it, activeshootersurvivaltraining.com.
We'll put all of this in the show notes as well. So if you're interested in anything that Michael offers or just want to find out more, just go to the show notes and we'll have links in there to everything.
That we will do. Awesome. Well, thank you ever so much. Michael, it's been a pleasure having you on, looking at active shooter training for the protector from John Moss and myself. This has been an exceptionally special and fantastic edition of the Circuit Magazine podcast. Thank you, Michael Julian. It was a pleasure to have you on, and also a pleasure to have you on the Bodyguards for Kids forum, which we as the Circuit Magazine supported. It was a pleasure to look at this and apply it to the protector, but also think of additional challenges and opportunities. What did you make of today's session, Doug?
Well, first of all, I mean, Michael's energy and his passion for this subject is so inspirational. You know, it really comes through. And that's got to be super important if you're training in this environment. I mean, so many challenges. It's like a life's work, isn't it?
It is. And I like the way that he's not just trying to explain how to deal with a situation, but he's also trying to get you to think about how to stop it happening in the first place, which, I mean, it is quite refreshing because quite often people say, incident is happening, let's respond. But if you can get ahead of the curve, if you can think about mitigation tactics, I mean, yeah, maybe his thought that, you know, we could eventually get a perpetrator to just, you know, work out in a gym and feel good about themselves, that's maybe quite utopian. But I like it, you know, somehow I feel it's adding more to the conversation.
Yeah, well, certainly, you know, when you look at, we touched on very near the end there, on technology and preventive measures that building owners can take in the planning and design of buildings, you know, right from when they're first being built to retrofitting. And I think there's a lot that can be done there. And yeah, so I think rather than sort of hypothesize about what might happen to, you know, these active shooters,